All right, guys, welcome to episode 11 of the Aquascaping Podcast. I'm your host, J-Art. Joining us today, as usual, is Sean. And we have a lot to talk about. Melting, trimming, CO2, lighting, mixing plant species together, cycling a new plant to tank for fish, fertilizing, surface agitation, Rotala, how close to plant stems together, growing low-light plants in high lighting, creating a grow-out tank to perpetuate future aquascapes, and much more. I'm about 6 days after planting the 20-gallon. I hesitate to call it an aquascape. It's a very basic design, but there's a lot of variety in there, and the main purpose of it is to learn how to grow these plants so that I can have a more defined and articulate design in aquascape the next time around. And I think that's a really good thing for beginners to do, and Sean was the one who made that suggestion. I just think that's a great tip for beginners. You know, start off with a simple design and try it a few different varieties, learn how they grow, and then you'll have experience and you'll be able to use them in a more articulate way the next time around. I had quite a bit of melting that started around the third day, and specifically on my finer leaf stems, my myriophyllum, almost completely disintegrated into mush. But there was a couple little green tips left. I snipped them off, I replanted them, and to my surprise, they are starting to grow. So I don't know if that was the right thing to do, but it seemed to have worked, and I think we're headed in the right direction. I'm doing about 30% water changes every day. I'm doing full estimated index, and even though I realize that at this point the stems and the plants are probably running off of stored energy, those water changes are kind of keeping everything in check. Just to name a few plants that are in there, we have some Iliocaris acicularis, which is the dwarf hair grass from my last aquascape. We have Hygrophila pinnatifida. Some Myriophyllum species, Ludwigia, some red and some orange species, which look great. Christmas moss tied up to some driftwood, along with some Anubias bonsai. A couple of Rotala species, Limnophilia, Didiplis deandra, some Java ferns, some Bulbitis African water fern, some Hydrocotyl lucifala, which is Brazilian pennywort, and Mayaca fluviatilis, which is also a fine-leafed stem. And that's just to name a few. So we have a lot in there. It's fully stocked, and I anticipate probably having to remove a few items as things grow in. But we'll see. This is an experiment for me. I'm looking forward to see how things grow out and mature. If you haven't realized yet, Sean has a lot more experience and knowledge than I do. But hopefully, you know, the goal here is to learn, and hopefully you guys are kind of coming along the ride with me as we talk to people. We're going to have some interviews coming up in the future, but, you know, I always enjoy talking to Sean. I learn a lot from him, and hopefully you guys too. So I called him up this week and talked to him about what's going on in the newly planted tank, and I had some questions for him, and I got a lot of good answers. So let's jump right over to that conversation. So, yeah, man, I got everything set up. I'm getting some melting going on.
Some melting, huh?
Yeah, quite a bit, actually, on a couple of them. I'm still learning the names. It's like learning a whole new language.
Yeah, and I had that when I started. I didn't know any of the scientific names, and I think I told you the story of when I first ordered plants, and they all came in, and I was putting them in my tank thinking this is great. And then it wasn't until months later that I realized that many of the plants I had ordered were not the plants I got. I had no idea. I once heard, don't make fun of someone who mispronounces a word because they probably learned it through reading. So, I mean, that's not a bad thing. It's just, we don't hear a lot of people saying it. I'm sure I pronounce them wrong all the time. And with my background, I should be able to pronounce Latin names better, but I mean, I'll be honest with you, no one goes through how to say them. It's just on how you hear people say them. And even in my professional experience work, I hear people pronounce things differently all the time. Yeah. And so I think as long as we all know what you're talking about, you're doing just fine. At least That's what I hope, because I'm pronouncing them wrong too.
So I have, I got a list of questions here. I guess I'll just kind of go through them. And the first one is, I guess let's just start with melting, I guess. Somebody sets up a new scape, and they plant everything. They got some stems into the substrate, and then melting happens. Now, that's a normal occurrence, but how much should somebody expect, before things start to kind of turn, you know, to the good side?
Well, I think it depends on the plants to some degree. Some plants are notorious for melting. Crips, for example, are pretty notorious for melting when you get them in a new setup. It's generally a sign the plants are adjusting to their new environment. There may be something different with the water. You may be planting plants that were previously grown immersed, and so they're transitioning growth forms. I think if you see a little melting is not a big deal. In some plants, it may be a sign something isn't quite going right, because some plants just don't have that tendency to melt. They're pretty hardy.
Right.
And so it does depend upon the plant. And the thing to look for is, are you getting good root growth? Are you getting new shoots and things like that? If you see that, then the plant is most likely just adjusting. And after, I think, you know, about 2 weeks, you should be seeing some pretty good growth. I wouldn't panic within the first few days. I've had Blixa melt completely down, and it shot right back up. And the thing is, you don't want to start pulling it out, because then you might pull out the stem that's still alive or some of that root that's going to grow the new plant as it melts away. So generally, I say with the melting, I mean, if it's a leaf, trim it off, get rid of it, because that's just going to dirty the tank a little. But for stems and things, leave them be for the most part until you start seeing new growth. And if you don't see new growth within 2 weeks, then I'd start to be a little concerned about what's going on in the tank.
So it's important really not to freak out if you see, you know, melting, like you said, because maybe that can recover and come back. You know, this, I have a tendency to, you know, if I see something melting or I see something not going right, to either pull that out or move it or do something like that. But I can almost guarantee that that is not really the right thing to do. So what you're saying is, even if you have some melting or you see some issues, is just to kind of just leave it alone and let it recover on its own.
Yeah, especially in a new setup. I think this, I see this a lot in people with not a lot of experience, is they immediately want to start tweaking everything and changing everything.
Yes,
what's
yes.
going on? And what you're doing is, you're not giving the plants a chance to adjust and acclimate. You're changing things all the time on them, and you're not helping them out. And you think about it, if they're, when with the energy that they're using to grow in the very beginning, when they're adjusting and acclimating, is a lot of stored energy. They're not taking in a lot. They're using stored energy. And so if you start really stressing them out, they're going to run out of their reserves for new growth and to be able to utilize the light in your tank and the CO2 in your tank and all these other things that are there. You are going to hamper their acclimation.
In general, I'm just kind of talking in general terms, but stem plants, how close do you plant them? I know, you know, we all want to get that really bushy effect. But from what I'm reading and what I'm researching, that all kind of comes through trimming. But how close do we really want to have those stems right in the beginning?
I like to plant, depending on, you know, the size of the stem, smaller, thin, fine stems. I think you can plant probably 5 of them in a bunch right next to each other. And then another 3 to 5, you know, a little ways away, maybe an inch. You got to remember, as they bush out, they're going to start to choke each other. If they grow really dense, those bottom stems, you don't want them being smothered out, because then the plants are going to, that bottom's going to melt away. If they're not, you know, be able to get some flow and some nutrients and CO2. So I generally do 3 to 5 stems every inch or two, in a kind of a grid through the area that I want to plant and grow them.
Here's a useful aquascaping quick tip for you. Sometimes it can be difficult to prime canister filters, particularly if you have some things plumbed in line with them, like a Surgis style CO2 reactor, that may prevent the priming mechanism, if it's built into the canister filter, from actually working appropriately. Or many filters don't even have a built-in filter priming button or mechanism. So what you can do is you can use the back end, the bulb from a turkey baster, and if you have a lily pipe or some similar glass pipe that you are able to create a seal in, you can basically squeeze that and then suction without putting your mouth over the outlet to pull water down in through your inlet and then start the priming process for your filter. It's really useful for me because I like to run reactors, and so oftentimes it's difficult to prime them. Sometimes you have to empty them out in order to get the filter to prime. And this is a good way to just kind of skip some steps and get straight to priming your filter and get it running smoothly.
you know, once things kind of grow in, once you have, you know, positive growth, and you make that initial trim. Well, before we even get there, how long do you wait until you make that first trim?
For me, I like to trim stems early. And by early, I mean probably about 3 to 4 weeks. Right after they've really established some good growth, they got some good root structure, and they're starting to grow out. This is to kind of tame them a little bit and then begin that process of bushing it out. So the first trim is really to cut them back a little, encourage a lot more growth near the bottom. And then the second trim I do is after they have gotten overgrown. So then I trim it back and I shape it a little bit, but that's not quite the shaping trim yet. Then I do a third trim where I really focus on trying to shape it. I'm cutting it just a little below where I want it.
Right. And now I've kind of seen a couple different things out there on the forums. Now, do you ever want to replace that initial stem that you planted? In other words, do you want to make that a trim and then replace that initial stem with the trimming? Or do you want to always keep that stem in there and just continually trim it down and trim it down?
Depends on the style scape you're doing. And so in Dutch scapes, they tend to top them and replant. That's how you can get that really nice, very conformed look. Because it's hard to tame them if you trim them back and let the bush grow out, and then trim them back and let the bush grow out. They tend to be a little more unruly, a little more wild. Whereas, and it depends upon the plant as well. So there's some plants out there like Pogostum monstellatus, where after you trim it, it really takes a long time for it to recover and grow out. And so in trimming that plant, sometimes it might be advised to top it and then plant the tops, because otherwise you're going to wait a really long time to get that look, and the rest of the scape may get ahead of it.
Right, right. And let's talk about CO2 for a second. Full blast, right? Right off the bat, you don't want to kind of like wean into, you know, say 35 parts per million. You want to kind of start right off the bat, high CO2, full lighting. Also, I'm thinking like 6 hours on this new scape until things kind of come in. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I like to back off the duration and not necessarily the intensity when I start, so 6 hours. But if you have the capability to back off the intensity a little bit while things settle in, that's not a bad idea either. Because that high light, that energy is not being utilized right at the startup. So it gives you a better chance of kind of fending off that initial algae bloom if you're backed off your light a little bit. So I'll go 6 hours, the beginning of escape, until I really start to see good growth. Things are filling in, they're denser, and then I'll hit it with an increased light. So I'll go to 8 hours, and then 10 hours is my maximum. I won't run light any longer than 10 hours. I think if you're passing 10, you're just asking for problems with algae.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember seeing in Amano's books, him running, you know, for such a long duration, but I think from what I'm finding out, he was using a little bit less light, so he was able to get away with more duration. But a lot of us out there, you know, we're cranking a ton of light in there, and we can definitely run into some problems if we're if we're running that for a long time.
Yeah, I think with light, there's a few things that combine to kind of make up the amount of light that you're putting over your tank. So there's duration, there's the intensity. And you can adjust those things. And so if you go lower light, you can probably increase the duration. If you go higher light, it's probably better to have a shorter duration of that high light. That's why I love lights with dimming features, especially if they're programmable. So you can run the high light for, say, 8 hours, and then you can back off the light to a lower intensity for, you know, maybe 2 hours on one side the morning and then 2 hours in the evening. So you extend your viewing time without having to kind of get funky with the times your light is on, say starting the light on at noon so you can watch it in the evening after dinner, for example, type of a thing. Instead, you can just dim the light and have that extended viewing period. I don't like to delay my start of my lights, especially in tanks with lots of stems, because that ambient light from the windows tends to cause them to grow funky. So they'll start leaning towards that light across the room from a window.
No kidding.
If you really delay it a lot, yeah, I have my 30 centimeter. There's windows kind of all around in the room it's in, and the light turns on at 10 o'clock. Well, that's, you know, that's probably 4 hours of daylight already that's kind of into the room, and I can see them bend. And they'll bend back once that light's on towards a more intense source. But I just don't like to do that, so I'd rather do dimming at the ends of my light cycles or beginning so that I can get some viewing time and not goof up my stems.
Now, as far as surface agitation, I'm running these two hang-in-the-back filters, and I know everybody's probably like, what the heck are you doing? They're so old school, and they have a lot of surface agitation. Now, I'm not seeing actually any – it's not affecting my CO2. At least I don't think it is. How bad – I mean, I don't think surface agitation is bad, but why do we try to get away from that, you know, by using canister filters and other things like that? You know, why do we not want to have that much surface agitation?
Surface agitation leads to CO2 degassing. So if you're using pressurized CO2, you're going to have to compensate your injection rate for a greater CO2 or greater surface agitation. You want a ripple for sure. You want gas exchange occurring at the surface, and you don't want a stagnant surface, because then your oxygen levels will most likely dip, which means you're going to have a harder time injecting CO2. Your fish, your livestock are going to get more stressed because they're not going to have as high of oxygen levels. You're probably going to have a biofilter that's going to suffer because the biofilter has a large oxygen demand on the system as well. So that surface agitation is important for gas exchange between the environment and the tank. But if you have a lot of it, you're going to have a really hard time getting enough CO2 into your tank.
Fertilization. Full right in the beginning, or should we kind of, you know, wean our way into a full fertilization regimen, or what's your take on fertilizing in the beginning of a
plant? In the beginning, I think it depends on the type of soil you've used. And so if you're using a nutrient-rich substrate like aqua soil, then I don't think you really need to jump on full-on fertilizing in the beginning. The aqua soil has mostly everything that we need. So, for example, I just helped a friend set up a 60-centimeter tank. It's running medium light, pressurized CO2, and aqua soil. The plants are pretty easy plants. And so I told him, you know, we'll start fertilizing. And I like EI daily because I like that daily dose of fertilizers in there. Whether it makes a difference or not, you know, people can make a case either way. But I told him, let's wait for about week three. And so this week I'm going to make up some solutions for him and we'll start fertilizing on 3 weeks out. If you have an inert substrate, I think it's probably good to start with some fertilizing right off the bat, depending upon what your tap water is. Inert substrates are generally probably going to be with a more low-tech tank, and so you don't probably need to fertilize a lot. I like to use 1/3 EI for lower-tech, lower-light tanks. But with an inert substrate, that's where I would start, and then see what's going on with your plants. If you see that your plants may need more, you can certainly adjust up as needed. So that's kind of what I recommend doing. It depends on the substrate mostly. Do you have nutrients in your substrate? And if you don't, probably start off right off the bat. If you do, you can probably wait a few weeks.
Cool. All right, if you have a dwarf hair grass carpet or any other carpet that requires a lot of trimming and a lot of small pieces, you know that could be quite messy and kind of a pain in the neck to get all those pieces out. One thing you could do is get a small gravel filter, the smallest one you can find that hardly siphons any water out at all, and clip the end into the bucket so you don't have to hold on to it, so that you can use your other two hands to trim and hold the siphon just above it to suck those trimmings right directly out of the tank and into the bucket. Rotala. Just in general terms, and you know, I'm still learning which ones are which inside the tank, because you know, like I mentioned on the last show, I got a lot of these plants from your trimmings, and you know, it's funny because all of a sudden I went from, you know, growing that dwarf hair grass aquascape, and I felt very accomplished, to feeling just like a beginner all over again. You know, it was like, yeah, I'm not sure which plants are which or how exactly to plant them. And there's a lot of things that suddenly I had to learn, you know, pretty quickly. And it's overwhelming. And I could imagine a lot of people out there, especially in their first aquascape implanting, they get kind of overwhelmed. And, you know, if they see melting or if they see things not looking fantastic for the first couple weeks, they might get, you know, a little bit, you know, stressed out or disappointed. But, we all have to kind of like stick in there. And I kind of went off topic here, but I was trying to get back or get around to Rotala. And do you have any tips and tricks on growing that in general and what your experience is with it?
Rotala, the whole genus is a really nice genus to grow. There's a lot of variations. There's lots of different species. And within some of the species even, there's variations that are pretty drastically different. It grows really well for the most part if you can provide it with ample light and good CO2. It responds very well to trimming. You can hack the heck out of it. It'll grow back bushier and stronger every time. So that's really great about Rotala. It's generally, you know, there are some that'll work okay mid-ground as long as you keep it nice and trim, but it's generally a background plant, something that is going to grow tall and thick in the background. There's really not a lot of, I mean, tips, I guess, for growing it. There are some species that are harder to grow than others, and so some that are good ones to start with, Rotala indica. I like Rotala hurrah, which, again, it might be a variation within a different Rotala species. It's probably not a species of its own. I just started growing Rotala, what is it? I cannot remember. I'm going to say this completely wrong because I can't quite remember what the name is, but Naha Genshin, or I can't remember what it is, but I really like it. It's a great fine-leaved green plant. It responds very well to trimming. It's very thick and dense, and it gets a little orange at the top, just a very slight coloration at the tips. I've grown Rotala Singapore in the past. Grows very much like Rotala Hurrah, except it gets a little pinker. That's a very nice plant as well. I think Rotala is a very good plant. If you're looking at getting a stem plant, you don't have a lot of experience with stem plants. They're a great genus to start with.
Yeah, and what I'm noticing too is now that I'm really kind of studying all the different varieties of the stem plants, some look very, very similar to others, but they might be very much different, or it might be a lot harder to grow one than the other. So why not just stick to the easiest of plants if there's such a small difference in the way they look? Why go for a harder to grow plant?
It's a good question. I'm not sure why. If your goal is to make a nice looking scape, I think it really would be a nice idea to try and stick with the easier to grow version, or a plant that's easier and will give a similar look. I think if you're really looking for a particular look, some plants and some difficult to grow plants are going to give you a very unique look. Some aerials can do that where just nothing looks like them. And again, within each genus, there's variations that are, some are easier to grow and some are harder to grow. Some people, I think if they want to grow something that's difficult, it's for growing the plant. It's kind of a collecting thing. It's seeing if I can grow it. And I've definitely tried that at times too, where I'm going to say, okay, I want to grow, see if I can grow this plant. And sometimes some of those really hard to grow plants, I can't figure out where they look great on an aquascape anyways, because you can't really shade them out if they're not very competitive. They grow slow, or, amongst other plants that are weedier, they're going to struggle. And so in an aquascape with a lot of different plants too, I think it's a challenge to grow harder plants just because they don't compete as well.
It's just so cool because, like I said, you sent me over so many different plants, so I'm already kind of learning which ones are more delicate, which ones are taking. Ludwigia, I think I'm pronouncing that right. You sent me a couple of those red varieties. Those seem to be actually doing the best out of everything.
So that's a really nice red plant to grow. That's not very difficult. And I think, so that brings up a point about sometimes people will grow plants that don't, under good growing conditions, which is moderate light, good CO2, don't get a lot of color. And so they want to force that color into them by throwing lots of light on them. And that makes your job a little more difficult as an aquascaper because you're having to try and manage this really high light in order to get color out of a plant. Whereas you can probably pick a plant and it may not look quite the same, but you know, I think picking reds that stay red under medium light is a really good idea to get red because it's going to be make your whole scape easier to manage versus trying to force reds or pinks or things into plants that don't normally get that color unless under very intense light.
And the way my tank is set up, one side of it's a little bit higher than the other. And the side that's higher has actually some of the lower light plants in there. So they're getting more light. It looks to be around, if I remember, 85 to 90 par. Now, is that overdoing it for something like a fern in a moss?
You know, I think when you're starting to get past 60 micromoles par, and I think Scape Foo had a really good light episode. So if anybody is interested in lighting, you need to go listen to the Scape Foo episode with Kara Wade. It talks a little bit about, she talks a little bit how par meters aren't that great.
Right.
But I think the good thing about a par meter is it gives us at least a measure, whether it relates to what we think it relates to all the time, maybe not, but at least it gives us some point of comparison. And I think once you start passing 60 micromoles, par, you're moving into medium light territory. And you need pressurized CO2. I think that's a good idea. Unless you really have some a lot of thick plant growth and some shading, then you can maybe get away with it. Stems will do okay, I think, in lower tech non-CO2 tanks with about that. You know, I was talking about my friend's 60-centimeter tank, and he picked out, we were going through Amano's Nature Aquarium book. I was telling him, you know, pick a scape you like. And he picked one that had driftwood as kind of a center focal piece with Anubias nana on it. And so, and a lot of carpet underneath. And to get a nice thick carpet, you're going to need a fair amount of light. So 60 to 80, I mean, 40 I consider really low or the bottom limit, I suppose. You can probably get growth for some plants below that. So where am I going with this? So anyways, in that tank, Anubias nana is on the branches, and it's the highest plant, and it's going to be in the tallest, highest light zones, which is a challenge, and we're probably around 100 par in that area, and we can dim it, so that's at the light's at the highest capacity, about 100 or so. I think it can be done, and it can grow well. I've seen people grow Anubias in ridiculously high lights, up high, without a shred of algae on it. I don't exactly know how they always do it, but it's doable. I wouldn't recommend trying it. So I think you should be fine. Fern is a low light plant. It can grow in low light. And those slower growing plants, they just tend to accumulate algae easier. And so, you know, you hack back a stem, it gets new growth. It's not there so long that it accumulates algae, whereas a Anubias leaf might be there for almost the duration of the scape. So it's going to have a tendency to gather algae if it's getting too much light.
Yeah, you know, that first initial stage is the hardest, because at least it is for me. I'm sure it is for everybody else too, because you know in like a month or two things are going to look awesome. And you just got to wait. You just got to be patient and kind of sit through that initial growth phase and those troubles that we all run into in the beginning.
Yeah, and don't panic if you get algae. I get algae in my tanks all the time. The difference between, I guess, then and now is now I can grow plants better, and I don't panic when I get algae. I know I can take care of it. I know how to do so. So getting algae is going to happen to everybody. My 45-centimeter has a stupid amount of light over it because I don't really like the dimmer with it. It makes the light look funny, so I don't use it. But it has a lot of light, and it was an uagumi, and so it had low plant density, and I've had algae in it since probably it's been flooded, you know, started with diatoms and now there's some green algae, but nothing that I'm too concerned about. Once the HC and some of the other plants really start growing aggressively, I'll cut it away. The new growth won't have it and we'll be done with it.
Cycling a tank for fish, a heavily planted tank. I've read a couple different things online. I've seen opinions both ways. What's your take on it? Do we need to wait a little while to add fish, or if we're heavily stocked with plants, aren't they going to kind of take care of the ammonia and keep things to a safe level for the fish? You know, you don't want to overstock and add a whole bunch, but, you know, just a few in the beginning. What is your take on that?
I think you can take a number of approaches, and it's going to also depend upon the substrate you choose, because aqua soil is notorious for leaching ammonia at the startup. And so I wouldn't put fish in an aqua soil scape until it's cycled, because you're going to have greater peaks of ammonia and then nitrites, which are harmful to the fish. And so I would wait until it's cycled with aqua soil, generally 3 to 4 weeks. And that's another reason why lots of frequent water changes in the beginning of an escape with aqua soil are very important, because you can keep those spikes kind of leveled out a little bit by removing water, adding clean water. If you aren't using aqua soil and you're using something else that doesn't give an ammonia spike, fluorite, EcoComplete, or just inert sand or something, you can do a fishless cycle. Sure, even with lots of plants, you can also get, there's a lot of biostarter products out there. Seachem makes Stability. I know there's other products out there that say you can add fish in the beginning if you use them. I've done that and haven't had a problem. It adds basically the bacteria to jumpstart the cycle. And by adding the bacteria numbers, you prevent the large swings in ammonia and nitrite by dosing it daily throughout the cycle. And then you can also do a fish in cycle. I mean, there's certain, when I, long time ago before I even kept plants, I did the fish cycles and I picked hardy fish. Zebra Daniels are the go-to for a fish in cycle. They're very tough fish. So that's another option. Depends on the fish you're keeping as well. If you are keeping some pretty tough fish, you can start with a few in the beginning and do a fish in cycle, especially with plants. Plants are really good at sucking up, you know, that extra ammonia that's going to be present in the beginning of your scape. But I think to give your scape the best start, I like fishless cycles to start. You can focus on the plants. You can focus on a lot of those water changes without having to worry about fish. And then you maybe can pick your fish and your shrimp later to match your scape versus picking fish that are going to survive, you know, the cycle.
What do you think about letting stems, or even doing it on purpose, even planting stems together, intermingled, just to kind of let it grow completely wild? Is there any harm in doing that? Are the plants going to outcompete each other? You know, I understand it might not look the best, but as far as the health of the plant, is there any harm in doing that?
Well, it depends on the plants. I think you don't want to try and mix in, you know, a slow-growing stem surrounded by a lot of fast-growing stems, because when you trim them, you know, that slow-growing stem is going to get shaded out. Right. But if you mix different Rotella species, that can look kind of neat. You know, some Rotellas and Ludwigia. Looks nice, you know, some broader leaf plants in among these fine leaf plants. That's kind of that Wabi-Coussa style, that those Wabi-Coussas that ADA uses. They're a mix of plants. They're not just a single plant. And it looks really nice. It does. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that. I think just the thing you need to watch out for is if you're putting in slow-growing stems amongst a lot of fast-growing stems, because that slow-growing stem's just not going to make it.
Right. And you gave a tip before on an earlier show about, you know, maybe your first scape is just growing plants, just to learn how each one of them, you know, how each one of them is. And I think that's such a great tip. You know, I think a lot of us just want to jump right into creating this amazing aquascape with no knowledge really of how the plants actually grow or even what they look like in person. You know, it was so interesting when that box came in the mail and I opened everything up. It was just like, wow, they looked so different from how I saw them online. You know, you don't really have a true sense of the scale of the plant, how it really looks. So there's like really so much to learn. And I just think that's a really good tip that you gave on, you know, your first scape, maybe even your first couple. It's just learning how to grow the plants, just doing some sort of basic layout. And then once you have like that, you know, that experience, then apply it, you know, going forward. You know, this hobby is full of, you know, patience. You really, really need patience in this hobby. In that, you know, that really good scape, that might come along in maybe a year or two after you learn how everything grows. I mean, you can get lucky, but I just think that was a really, really good tip that you gave there.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I that's what I did, and I found that was really, really valuable to me. And I think it doesn't mean that first tank has to be ugly. You know, it just means that don't put yourself on too much pressure or under too much pressure to do this really detailed looking scape, because most likely what you've looked at different plants, you know, that scaper has some knowledge about how to trim them, how to plant them, and some things that you haven't developed yet to get that look that you're trying to achieve. And so I think just start out with some real basics and learn how to grow the plants. You know, you don't even need hardscape. My first tank, I didn't put any, my practice tank, any hardscape in. Just put a row of some various foreground plants, a row of what you know to be various mid-ground plants, and then some background stems, and just see how they grow. And the more plants you try, the more proficient I think you'll get eventually as a scaper. That's one thing I like about my 55-gallon Wild Dutchman scape is I throw different plants in there just to kind of see how they grow, how to trim them. So I'm still trying to learn all the time about what this plant does or how does it look against this plant. I can see what leaves look good together, what colors and shades, and get ideas for upcoming scapes.
Yeah, and I mean that's a good idea too, to have just a grow out tank. You know, maybe if this is your first time, you know, kind of just experiment with different plants and maybe a 20 or 40 gallon tank and just get a bunch of different varieties. And then that first, you know, scape, quote unquote, could be in just a different aquarium. So you're just pulling plants out of that grow out tank. And you could do that. You could pretty much perpetually keep creating scapes just from your own little farm, I guess.
That's pretty much what I do. I order plants maybe once a year if I'm going to do a big rescape on my main 90 centimeter, but all my other scapes, for the most part, I pull plants from my existing scapes or some basic just tanks where I keep some plants. And that's nice because if I have a scape that I'm going, I don't like this, I don't feel bad taking it down and then planting whole new stuff in there that I have from another tank, because it doesn't cost me anything but time.
Okay, guys, I'm going to wrap up the show here. Thanks again for joining us on the Aquascaping Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and rate on iTunes. Check us out at aquascapingpodcast.com. And send in comments and questions to aquascapingpodcast@gmail.com. I hope everybody has a good week, and we'll see you next time.